kind of like, is that what sound like?
Welcome, everyone. We'll call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We have honorables here. We have three honorables here. So we will start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3058. Would all the honorables please come forward, including the one in the back.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3058A makes changes related to the corporate minimum tax, and for the purposes of the minimum tax paid by agricultural co-ops, it removes sales representing business done with or for members of the co-op from the definition of Oregon sales. Again, just for the purposes of determining or calculating the corporate minimum tax, and would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2011.
Okay, we're going to start off with Representative Hunt and Representative Jensen to speak on this. I assume that's why you're both here.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And my more senior colleague asked me to go first. So thanks for hearing this bill. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. This is really an issue that goes back to the definition from 2003 of single sales. Many of us voted for the single sales factor in 2003. I think it's been a real beneficial thing for Oregon businesses. But buried within that definition was one inherent flaw. If you are a Nike or an Intel or so many other companies where you sell your products directly to a customer outside of Oregon or internationally, you don't pay taxes because it doesn't count in the definition of Oregon sales. If you happen to be a wheat grower or another agricultural producer and you sell your product to an Oregon co-op, that even if it's ultimately bound for a customer outside of Oregon or outside the United States, you get stuck in the definition of Oregon sale. Now, many of those companies, so we have the challenge with the embedded definition of Oregon sale from 2003. Then that definition was applied more broadly in 2009, and all of a sudden a bunch of companies that never should have been subject to any tax, had just been paying $10 up until 2009, all of a sudden are paying now a larger corporate minimum. And so this is a fix to that. It goes back and revises that definition of Oregon sale specifically so it will exclude those sales that go through just agricultural co-ops, as you can see in on page 1, line 18 through 20, it specifically says that, so it only applies to agricultural co-ops, no other corporations, and specifically says that Oregon sales do not include sales representing business done with or for members of the agricultural cooperative. It does have a slight revenue impact. I think Representative Jensen and I would argue that never should have been a revenue that we were counting on in the first place, because I don't think anybody believed that either back in 2003 or in 2009 that the intent was to apply this basically double taxation at 2 points to growers and agricultural producers who are using agricultural co-ops. It's got it came over. Did it come out of the House unanimously? I think. Came out unanimously or near, I think it was unanimous in the House. Very, very, very broad support, supported by a wide variety of agricultural groups, and would commend it to you and urge your support to fix this long-standing problem that got worse in 2009.
Okay, and then how far would this reduce the minimum tax? It would just be, how would this, they'd still pay the baseline, right?
It would basically exempt all these sales from Oregon sales. Thus, you see the net revenue impact. I don't have the revenue statement in front of me, but I think it's about $700,000
right.
A year.
Chris?
I think it has to do with Oregon sales. So you have the cooperatives, and some of the sales they make are done with or for members, and some of the sales are from non-members. So in calculating the total of Oregon sales, they would only calculate the sales from business done with non-members. So the potential minimum tax would still be the whole range of the corporate minimum tax. It would just be a function of sales due to business with non-members. Okay. So it doesn't switch it to a specific amount per se. It would still be subject to the schedule that is in statute.
For
corporations, which ranges from $150 to $100,000.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's where the... Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't change that amount. It just changes how they determine Oregon sales for where they land, which will then affect how they where they land in that range.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Jensen, state representative from House District 58 in Pendleton, a district that has become massacred, I guess is the right word, as the process went through last week, and I'm not sure that I even know where I am anymore on the district, but be that as it may. I thank you for the opportunity to come and testify on this bill. Thank you for the hearing this bill. it was a situation that was recognized in the waning days of the last legislative session and brought to the attention of Representative Hunt and Speaker as to what was going on with it. And since that time, we have worked to try to find a fix for this particular issue, an issue that was, excuse me, unintended in the original legislation. And it is, quite frankly, if you are an Oregon producer, and you are selling to an Oregon co-op, it is a double tax on the product, on the gross receipt tax. And that doesn't seem fair, and furthermore, was not the intent of the legislation when it was enacted. Nor was it the intent to have the people of the state voting on legislation that did specifically that. So my colleague, Representative Hunt, has very well explained the part of it. I won't try to re-explain that to you. I will add that it makes considerable difference to many people in agriculture, and to not remove this would place not only our producers at something of a decided disadvantage, but I submit would probably also add to the cost of the product in an international market, which could jeopardize the markets that we have. So in those particular regards, I urge you to pass this bill out of committee and on to the floor of the Senate for approval of it. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions, or at least I'll be glad to refer them to Representative Hunt.
Well, actually, this one's for you, Representative Jensen. We all know that wheat is one of the products that's involved here. What other agricultural products go through these cooperatives?
excuse me, Madam Chair. Any product that would be sold out to an Oregon an Oregon co-op would be subject to relief, with this.
But in practice, does it cover a wide range of agricultural products, or just a few? Or
well, I would think, and I'm not, I'm not sure where all the markets are for all of the products that we have. But it would. Potentially cover a wide range. It certainly would cover all of the cereal grains of one form or another, and anything else that utilizes a marketing co-op, to be the go-between point between the farmer and the market there.
And I might just say to that, Madam Chair, the bill has drawn the support of the dairy farmers and the potato growers, Farm Bureau, and the Ag Cooperative Council. I think as we've looked into it, it's very disproportionately wheat. I mean, if you look at a percentage of a product, wheat very disproportionately goes through these co-ops. The others are much, much smaller. But as opposed to just applying it explicitly in statute to wheat, it seemed more logical to apply it to the somewhat broader category of ag co-ops.
And in that regard, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we would appreciate, of course, Oregon is a major wheat producer in the United States. I'm not sure where they rank nationally now, but they probably fifth of the states are the wheat producing states. And as far as the production of wheat in the state of Oregon, Umatilla County, which has been my house district now for some 15 odd years, is the number one wheat producing county in the state. So it's a pretty good size issue as far as House District 58 is concerned.
Senator Telfer. Got rid of a lot of reps in the room here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Jensen is the one that I'm asking the question to, but Representative Hunt, I can't remember who mentioned it, with double tax. How's this different than any other business who is producing something in Oregon and selling it to another Oregon company so that the producer pays tax, and then when the other Oregon company sells it, they pay tax again, double tax? I mean, what we're talking about is the gross receipts problem with Measure 67, that gross profit is no longer recognized, or direct cost of goods sold is no longer recognized. So how's the co-op different than another business that manufactures something in the state, sells it to somebody, Corporation B, Corporation A, the seller, pays tax on the gross receipts. When Corporation B sells it to somebody, they pay tax again on the same thing without being able to deduct the direct cost, the cost of goods sold. How's a co-op different than any other business?
I could take a shot at that, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer. I think probably in two ways. One, the vast majority of businesses that I can think of that operate internationally sell directly, you know, don't go through, unless they're going through an Oregon business who's then adding value, some kind of additional refining of a product or changing of a product. I'm struggling to think. There probably are some examples, but I'm not actually thinking of any examples right now. You know, it's not like Nike or Intel manufactures a chip here and then sells it to another Oregon company who then sells it to customers around the world. I think the vast majority of manufactured and produced products here are just sold directly. There is a hugely disproportionate dynamic, especially within wheat and some other agricultural products, where they do use this Oregon co-op model. Part of my concern is that if we don't make this change, all of a sudden there are going to be co-ops popping up in the state of Washington or in Idaho or in California, where there will be an incentive to actually sell to a Washington state co-op, because that will be an out-of-state sale, and all of a sudden it won't count. And I don't think we want to just randomly incentivize co-ops just relocating outside, since they really the co-ops don't change the wheat or other grains that they are passing through. They are really a collection and transportation and marketing point. They're not changing the product, unlike some other industries.
Follow up, please.
Well, I might venture to say that some of these co-ops could change their entity structure so that they're not C corporations and subject to the gross receipts. But sure. I can think of an example, maybe tennis shoes that are produced in Oregon, sold to a shoe sales store, retail, it's double taxed. Nike would pay tax when they sell it to the distributor or the retail store, so to speak, and then the retail store pays the tax again. So I guess I'm just looking for some equity here. So I'm not necessarily opposed to the co-op situation, but I do know that it's also in other entity forms, any other industries, not just co-ops.
And Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I think one point Representative Jensen made earlier that's especially important as it relates to wheat and probably just about every other agricultural product in Oregon, is the margins. Unlike tennis shoes, which have a pretty healthy margin on them, wheat and a lot of these agricultural products operate on almost no margin. So you add a few cents per ton of additional cost, and all of a sudden, as Representative Jensen said, they are completely uncompetitive in the global marketplace. So that is a difference between an Intel chip or a Nike tennis shoe or some other.
I remember that verbiage in the Measure 67 campaigns, you know, has nothing to do with margins. It was gross receipts. Some industries have very small margins and gross profits, and some have larger. But that argument didn't work back then. So anyway, thank you. Thanks for the answer.
Other questions from the committee? If you two want to leave, you may, or you may stay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All yours, Senator.
Thank you.
Welcome, Senator George.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry George, State Senator for Senate District 13. I'm actually here today. I don't want to act like I'm acting as a senator. I'm actually acting in a pretty narrow interest of the company that I own with my brother, George Packing Company. So I'm going to specifically talk about how this bill would impact businesses. To do so, we have to kind of put it in a little bit of there's some really complex tax law that factors into how agriculture producers are taxed, both in federal law and state law. And Senator Telfer, you're correct. In our particular industry of hazelnuts, there is one agricultural co-op, which is the biggest processor in our industry, and there's 15 small independent folks that are not co-ops that compete with that co-op. So that's the structure, and so you hit on it exactly. Under the World Trade Organization, WTO, when they came in and dealt with U.S. tax law as it applies to agricultural products, they made Congress go in and basically threw out a number of the tax advantages for our exporters under federal law. And in doing so, Congress came back and said, what could we possibly create that would create a tax structure that would allow us to incentivize export-oriented industries? So these are export-oriented industries, not necessarily all exporters. Agriculture obviously pops up very, very high in that group. They created two basic structures that allow you to compete internationally and tax benefits internationally when you're competing on the world market. The United States only produces about 5% of the world's hazelnuts. So we compete in a world market. One was a tax deduction called the Domestic Production Activities Deduction, which allows us, in essence, for that product to get a tax deduction on our net profit that exceeds what other businesses would because we qualify for the Domestic Production Activities Deduction. And the other is a structure called the Domestic International Sales Corporation, which is specifically for exporters. In 2009, there was a ruling by the IRS that the Domestic Production Activities Deduction as applied to agricultural co-ops, if the agricultural co-op structured their business in a specific way, would get the deduction not on their net sales. So let's say, for instance, their margin is 10%. Rather than getting the deduction on their net sales, it would be on their gross sales. So in essence, a cooperative and a private business that were competing against each other, one would in essence get a fraction, maybe as small as 1/8 the size of the deduction that you get. And it's not a small deduction, by the way. It's a significant deduction for all of us. The counter to that 2009 decision is that you as a private business could set up a domestic international sales corporation and take advantage of that in other states. Oregon does not recognize the domestic international sales corporation. It's just viewed as any other corporation, and you're taxed at maximum rate, which means you don't get any advantage whatsoever in the state of Oregon. I talked to the chair about this issue because what was happening with this IRS decision is that cooperatives were gaining a huge competitive advantage over all of their competitors with this IRS deduction. But in my conversations with the chair, I explained the need to also include into state law the Domestic International Sales Corporation as a way to balance the scales. It still wouldn't make it equal. Co-ops would still have a significant tax advantage, but it would balance the scales. We did it at the end of the session. If you remember, Madam Chair, we discussed this, and we both decided that since the cooperative bill was going to die in the February session, that we could live in the environment where they had this advantage with the domestic production activities deduction because Measure 67 applied to them and Measure 66 applied to us, but we could still survive in that environment. The problem with this particular bill here is that they already get a huge advantage in federal law under the domestic production activities deduction, then does a private business. But in addition, the private business's only alternative in federal law is the domestic international sales corporation, but we do not recognize that in state law. I did not think this bill was going to move this session, and Madam Chair, as you know, I came and talked to you and asked you several times if we thought this was going to move. I think we were both surprised that it moved out of the House. This bill is very, very difficult pill to swallow if you are a competitor with a co-op, an agricultural co-op, without state recognition of the international, or the domestic international sales corporation. Because it's one thing for them to have a big advantage, but then for us to also get the tax increase of 66-67 and then have to compete and they're exempted from that, it creates that differential that's even bigger. Like I said, in our industry, roughly 70% of the production is done outside of a co-op, and there's one cooperative and there's about 15 non-cooperative competitors. All I'm saying is this bill may be necessary, but it has to go in conjunction with state law to also recognize the other corporate structure that the federal government has given that would somewhat balance the scales. I don't know exactly where the number is to balance the scales because I don't think we could actually get there, but there has to be a state recognition of these domestic international sales corporations without creating a huge tax differential and tax disadvantage to anybody who is not a cooperative. So I've briefed the staff on the bill. I think they've done some research on it as far as checking out exactly what I was talking about. I have talked to the proponents of the bill. I don't have a problem with the bill per se, as long as it's balanced and state recognition of both of these structures it goes through.
I don't remember a discussion of joining the Domestic International Sales Corporation. It's kind of like a compact almost, right, that states enter into?
No, what it is, Madam Chair, is that these domestic international sales corporations are in an effort to deal with international trade. They're meant to give domestic producers a tax advantage in competing overseas. Yeah. Most of us in agriculture do that. And what these corporations do is allow you to, in essence, take operating income and get it taxed at a capital gains rate. Oregon doesn't recognize a differential between its capital gains rate and its regular income rate. So when Measure 66 went into effect, domestic international sales corporations saw a significant tax increase, but really we're missing out on a huge opportunity to help our exporters, and it would allow us to sort of equalize the tax advantage of the domestic production activities deduction. So it's not really a compact. It's basically an opportunity that the federal government has given us to give an advantage to our export-oriented companies here in Oregon. I guess on this particular one, we could narrow it so it's only domestic international sales corporations that sell agricultural products, and I think you would solve the differential problem. We still wouldn't be taking advantage of the opportunity, but at least you would save us from having this competitive advantage via tax policy.
And how does it work again? Do they give the deduction that would also reduce Oregon taxes, or is it just a reduction in federal taxes?
The way the domestic production activity deduction works is that after all of our taxes are calculated in those industries that qualify for this deduction, we then get an additional deduction to give you an idea of what the impact, and there's a discussion about it here, and I've got some more material if you're actually interested in how it works. But if you're at a top rate of, say, 39% federal tax, you could actually see your tax rate drop by as much as 3% under how it's applied to all of us that are in export-oriented industries. Okay, so it's a significant tax break for all of us to help us compete internationally. As it applies to cooperatives, what happens is they, rather than take it on their net profit, they basically can take it on all of their gross profit that is, or all the gross revenue that is from derived from membership and the in essence profit. That's then passed through as a deduction to their individual members. So if their individual members are C-Corps, S-Corps, LLCs, they then get that deduction broken up on a pro rata share to each of their members. So it ends up being a pass-through tax deduction. It's a significant advantage.
Okay. Okay, so the solution that you would recommend is to have individual companies qualify for the same, the gross base?
Well,
or is that how it would work?
The problem is that what's created this anomaly is two things that I can't really fix. One is a ruling in 2009, which is the piece of literature that you have in front of you, a ruling by the IRS in 2009 that applied the DPAD to gross revenue for agricultural co-ops, but applied it to net profit for non-cooperative agriculture industries. That's the first problem. The second problem is that all the businesses that are ag processing businesses get taxed under Measure 66 or 67, depending on their structure. Then their customers or their suppliers, or as Senator Telfer pointed out, their growers, are then also taxed, depending on what their structure is, under either 66 or 67. So the real problem here is that they are, in essence, given a, I'm using an extreme, but a 10 times bigger tax break under the DPAD. And then under Measure 66 and 67, this bill would allow them out. The only way I can figure out how to fix it would be to also then have the state of Oregon recognize the Domestic International Sales Corporation somehow for agricultural-oriented processors to somewhat level the playing field. You still wouldn't level the playing field. Cooperatives would still have a significant tax advantage over us, but we could at least live in that environment.
And has anyone figured out the revenue implications of doing that? I mean, this is $700,000. Do you have any sense of how?
Senator Burr, if I could, in the February session, I drafted some amendments to try to fix this issue. In fact, I think to this same exact concept that's coming through right now. And legislative revenue estimated at that time that an amendment to all ICDIS corporations, all of them, including agriculture and non-agriculture, would be somewhere near between $500,000 and $1.5 million for the biennium. If you limited that to just agricultural domestic international sales corporations, I'm guessing it would be proportionally smaller to the part that's actually agriculture in our economy. So it would be significantly smaller. I'm guessing Paul could give us a better answer, but I'm guessing that it would be much less than $500,000. But it's significant in this small industry.
Questions from the committee? Thank you for bringing this to us, but at this point you're not opposing the bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, all I'm saying on this bill is that it creates a huge problem for anybody who's competing against an ag co-op for 66 and 67 to be applied to us. Then on top of that, they get a federal tax break that we don't get, and the federal tax break that we do get that is available to us isn't allowed under state law. So it's kind of a double whammy. They're getting a huge tax break under federal law, and now this bill, they would get a tax break from the 66-67 that we would not be eligible for, and it creates a huge problem. So I don't want to stop these folks from getting their bill, because obviously I think they've been done wrong, but all of us were done wrong under Measure 66 and 67. I would repeal the whole thing, Madam Chair.
Okay.
That would clean it up.
Yeah, that would definitely clean it up. All right. Other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Okay, now we have a panel, Jana Jarvis, John McCulley, and David Buck.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon, and we will try in the few minutes we have with you answer some of the questions that have been raised and explain why we think House Bill 3058 deserves your support. As you have heard, House Bill 3058 is supported by the broad agriculture community. We think it's a bill that, Representative Hunt said, corrects an oversight that occurred in both 2003 and 2009. I'm going to just start with some basics about a cooperative. It is a very unique business structure. It is, in its purest sense, just an extension of the member's own business. It is owned by the members. One of the principles of a cooperative is that it is owned by the members. There are limited returns on equity. It is a nonprofit entity where the profits of the business, if there are any, are returned to the owners of that business, who are the members of the co-op. And so I think that's a key difference that needs to be recognized here, that we are seeking in this bill to have the single tax payment made by the owners of the business. And that is, I think, consistent with how other single tax businesses are taxed, be they partnerships, be they sole proprietorships or LLCs. The owners of those businesses pay the tax, and that's what we are seeking here through House Bill 3058, is the tax only being levied once on the actual owners of the business. As it stands now, the tax on the revenue from the business is taxed at the cooperative level, and when those same revenues are returned to the owners of the business, they are subject to taxation again. And we are seeking in 3058 just to have that tax applied once. To give you an idea of some of the companies, and the question was raised by you, I think, Madam Chair, we have a significant number of dairy cooperatives in Oregon. You already heard about hazelnut cooperatives. There are fruit and vegetable cooperatives. And then there are cooperatives that are supplying their members with machinery, with crop inputs, et cetera. So there's a wide range of different cooperatives. I'm estimating there are approximately 40 agriculture cooperatives in the state who would be affected by House Bill 3058. A couple of things that were done in the House that I think you should be aware of. The House did amend this bill to limit the scope, so it does only apply to agriculture cooperatives. It also made sure that any sales business done with non-members was subject to the same tax requirements as any other business. So those are two significant changes made in the House. And I would point out that there, as far as I know, three other states that tax corporate gross receipts, Ohio, Michigan, and Texas, I believe, all of them exempt cooperatives from that taxation. So I think this is consistent, and I think it's important that we separate what we do here as a policy, state tax policy, with whatever may be occurring at the federal level, which we have a little control over. So I would encourage the committee just to concentrate here on what is the appropriate policy for Oregon. And I brought Mr. Buck with me, David Buck, who works with cooperatives. He's a CPA, and I'm sure he can help answer some of the technical questions you may have about the bill.
All right. So did you want to testify as well?
Yeah, if I may, Madam Chair, my name's David Buck. I'm with the CPA firm of AKT here in Salem, and we do work with many co-ops in our office, familiar with the co-op laws, and I just wanted to maybe say some things to elaborate on what John has just said. Number one, in all due respect to what Senator George brought up, he brought up some very, very important points regarding what I feel are probably two other distinct areas of tax law that I would kind of hesitate to roll into this issue, with this domestic sales corporations and the domestic production activity deductions. Those are kind of standalone things that affect all businesses in some way differently. But in regards to this measure itself, John already said it, and I'll reiterate it. The cooperative structure is, as I understand, I'm not an attorney, but I've dealt with them long enough to know that the cooperative structure is from a legal perspective and a tax perspective, completely different from a standard company by to company sales between companies, and then the producer sells it to company A, company A sells it to company B, who may or may not be out of the state. Co-ops are different on many levels. One of which is they have a legal obligations, the entities, to return, as John pointed out, any we like to say net profit, but really at the end of the day, co-ops are cost organizations. They are mandated legally and by tax law to operate at cost, which means if they collect more than they pay, they have to turn that over to the members, because the essence of a cooperative is really just a bunch of people, members, if you will, coming together to have some marketing cohesion in getting their products out. And at the end of the day, that entity is legally obligated to give them those revenues. So it's conceptually more of a single taxation theory and not really the co-ops making a profit or the members making a profit sending to the co-op and then the co-ops making a profit beyond there. It's really all the individual members' profit at the end of the day that's returned to them in some fashion. And that's why I think this bill makes a lot of sense, because it's been quite an onerous thing for a lot of co-ops to now have to start paying tax on dollars that they never get to retain. It all has to go back to their members by law, at least in regards to the member operations. And also, as was pointed out a couple times, any non-member activity, because co-ops do engage in activities with people who aren't members, as John pointed out, those activities will entirely fall under the purview of all other corporate tax law, because in a legal and a tax sense, that's how they're dealt with. They have to pay tax just like any other corporate entity on those non-member activities.
Okay. Actually, I think I'll ask you now. There was some kind of an exclusion for, there was a distinction between members and non-members. Can you give me some, for instances, of what that, obviously, if someone is as a member of a cooperative, I understand that, but how do non-member transactions take
place? Well, really, it's just you could have one person being a member who sells his product to the co-op, and then the co-op sells it on. That whole transaction line, all the costs and benefits, all the costs and profits related to that transaction ultimately find their way back to the member.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the co-op goes out and it buys some product. It needs to supplement some of its sales because it has to fill an order and the members just didn't produce enough. So they have to go out and get some product from a non-member.
Mm-hmm.
And those dollars, they're under no obligation. That's open market transaction. They're not legally obligated to buy that product from this non-member. They just need it to fulfill their orders on behalf of the members. So they go out and buy that order. And any profit they may realize on that doesn't go back to that non-member. It stays in the cooperative, and the cooperative is going to pay either the minimum tax or the regularly computed tax, whichever is higher, just like any other corporate entity has to do. So remember, co-ops, as we all know, don't exclusively work with members. That's not real world. Their goal is to work primarily for their members, and most co-ops are far and away the majority of their businesses with members, but there is some non-member activity, and there's no intent under this bill to change that at all, to change the taxation of that at all.
So in this case, the non-member would pay the tax for the revenue that they receive for the product, and then the co-op would also pay.
That's right. And those revenues that the co-op gets would go under the guise of the minimum tax structure as well, and if they rose to the level where the minimum tax would be paid, then it would be paid.
And if the co-op sells the product, whether it's from a member or not, outside of Oregon, how does that?
I guess I'm not as well I understood the earlier discussions from Representative Hunt as far as the single tax issues that came up over the years. But I think at the end of the day, from my perspective, those sales that go out, whether the sale is done out of state or in state, if those sales are products produced by the members, they'd be excluded from sales for purposes of the minimum tax calculation. If the product was from non-members, it would be considered Oregon sales for the minimum tax, regardless of whether it was in-state or out-of-state sale by the co-op.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking around for Chris.
I think I was trying to follow the answer there, but I think if for the co-op, for these non-member sales, if they're sold out of state, they're not part of the base for the minimum tax. The minimum tax was in state.
Right.
So I can't think of any part of law that would make them distinct. It's really, because in that case, it would be just like any other C-Corp.
I apologize. I understand I missed the context of that. Yes, to the extent that they would otherwise not be considered Oregon sales because they were out of state, then yes, they would not be included, just like any other corporation. Thank you.
So in the current law, even if it's a member sale, without this bill, even under current law, if the co-op sells it out of state, they're still not taxed on it. The double taxation only occurs. Oh, wait a minute. No, the co-op has to pay the taxes for sending the money back to the, how does it work? I mean, how does it interrelate with the single sales factor under current law? So the co-op buys the product from the member, and then the co-op sells it. Say they sell it to a Japanese customer. Mm-hmm. Are they taxed on that? I don't think so.
It's been my understanding that they are.
How would that, why wouldn't that
source
be?
Revenue?
Why wouldn't
Pardon me?
Source revenue.
Because it's an out-of-state sale?
But I would think that that would be covered by the single sales factor if it was out of the state.
Okay, that may be right.
The source isn't in Oregon, so it's not taxed. Source is not in Oregon. So
okay,
source
then I agree.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to understand. It's not really relevant to this bill.
Well, I think also they're again trying to carry it back. I know when Senator George brought up a lot of issues. My concern in that was there's a lot of things out there that can interact, and I know you can only go so far sometimes as to how you can address those. But I wanted to make sure we brought it back to the essence of it, that it's a different type of an organization that is different from, even though it's under the corporate legal structure, it's a certain division of the corporate legal structure that's for co-ops, and they have a lot of obligations that they're obligated to buy that product from the members. It's not like an open market where they can just go buy it from whoever, and or they can, those members can sell it anywhere. They have to go through their cooperative. That's why the single tax structure really seems to make the most sense to make sure that that's carried through the organization, clear onto the sale to the members, and to make sure that those member sales are not subject to the minimum tax and considered to be Oregon sales.
All right, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Buck, is the issue you talked about the net income, et cetera, but the issue here really in the double taxation is the gross receipts part of the tax law. And what's unfair is I'm a grower. I sell to the co-op $50,000 worth of wheat. I have $50,000 revenue. I pay tax on the $50,000. The co-op turns around and sells it for $55,000. They're paying tax on $55,000. So it's the double tax without being able to get to the cost of goods sold and get to at least gross profit. So the issue there, it's a double taxation because of the gross receipts element of the law. Is that not correct for the most part?
I think that's how it plays out. Yes, once you get beyond the fact that a co-op structure is supposed to be kind of conceptually one sales transaction, but in this case, because it goes through a co-op, as you mentioned, a product that's ultimately sold for $55,000 in the Oregon system has gross receipts of $50 by the producer and another gross receipts of $55 by the co-op. When it's really in a cooperative setting, one transaction, the co-op's simply paying the member a kind of a first fruits of their revenues until the whole sales transaction to the outside public is done, and then through the computation of what the real profits were, they give the members the rest. So it's really only one transaction, but it shows up in the Oregon law now as two gross receipts transactions.
Follow up, please. So it's similar then in really one product. There's no value added to it. It's one product going down the chain and being taxed numerous times, such as a box of tennis shoes. For instance, to use an example, Nike would pay tax on the shoes as they sell them to the retail operation under the gross receipts part of the current law. The retail operation would pay tax again on the same pair of shoes on gross receipts basis without any recognition of cost of goods sold as a deduction or even gross profit, much less net income.
I think that would make sense if the setting were a producer selling on the open market to an entity that wanted their goods, but in a cooperative setting where they're, as members, when they sign on, they're legally obligated, they grow those crops on behalf of the cooperative, they have to market it through the cooperative sells it for them. The structure isn't designed to be two steps, even though when you back up, you can say, well, isn't it two steps? No, it's the cooperative simply marketing those products. I think that's exactly right in a situation, in a non-cooperative situation where the buyers and sellers are free to buy and sell their goods between entities as they wish, but members and a co-op, they're set up for the purpose of marketing their product as members, to market their product and the co-op is not designed to make a profit on their own that they keep to build their business. They have to return that profit back to the members. Legally, they're bound to do that.
So the difference is, let's say the ultimate sale of $55,000, $5,000 is used to do the marketing, do the payroll, do operating expenses. There's no profit. So the tax is really only paid on the $50,000 at the agricultural farmer's level, not at the co-op level.
In that example, that's exactly right.
But if, in fact, there was $1,500 net income, which goes then back to the agricultural producer, they pay tax on $51,500.
Right. It's as
co-op pays nothing.
Pardon me. Yes, it's as if they sold their product with. In reality, they sold their product for $51,500. In your example, that's a good analogy.
$55,000 is never taxed. Fully taxed as any other C corporation in this state pays. Every other C corporation in this state will pay tax on the $55,000, but not a co-op, because the first producer is the one that's paying the tax on the $50,000 or the $51,500.
Well, it's hard telling, because the depending on who the producer is, if they're a C corporation, they'll be paying tax on the $51,000. If they're not a C corp, then they'll be paying income tax on those dollars.
No, if they're a C corporation, they'll be paying tax on the $55,000 gross receipts. They're not allowed to take the deductions for marketing and all the operating expenses. That's what I'm saying. They're a C corporation, but they don't pay any tax. And the only tax that's paid really is $51,500. The $3,500 is never taxed. That the expense. That's the difference between a gross receipts tax and a net income tax, which is what Oregon currently has. I'm just saying. All my point is, C corporations pay tax on $55,000 with no recognition of the deduction for just the cost of the product to turn around and sell.
I understand, yes.
Other than agriculture is what we're looking for right now.
And
carve out for agricultural co-ops.
I understand. I know that, at least in the businesses we serve, far and away the vast majority of the members in cooperatives are individuals. There can be corporate members as well. But, I understand your point. Thank you.
Okay. Jenna?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a fun issue to bat cleanup on, I can tell you that. I'm representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and I believe we started this conversation with Representative Hunt. Did I not say Jana Jarvis? I apologize. Jana Jarvis on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Obviously, I've forgotten who I am today. Yes. In any event, I think if you would indulge me for about a minute, I just want to go back to the beginning of this. This was an issue that came up, and if you think about wheat as a product, you recognize that there's no one wheat producer or farmer in this state that can sell their product directly to Japan. And so they come together, those farmers come together, create this co-op, aggregate their product in grain elevators, put them on barges, and ship them overseas. And that process of aggregating them through the co-op is the issue that has come up today from a tax standpoint. The farmer and the co-op are essentially the same entity. And so the gross receipts tax created a disincentive because they were not able to, because of the pass-through revenue provisions in that. But I think another point that needs to be made today is we have to remember that these are commodity products too, and it's not, these are prices that are, they're competing at internationally, they're prices that are set. And so there's operating at the lowest cost, possible cost in order to compete in a world market for these products is also extremely important to our members. I'm not quite sure what else there is to add here today, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay. All right, thank you. We have no one else signed up. Is there anybody else who wants to talk on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3058. And committee, do you want to hang on to this? Realistically speaking, we've got one more meeting. We've got all the paperwork we need today, so I'm looking for...
I'm okay with it.
You okay with it? Okay. I will open a work session on House Bill 3058. And we have a, is this one we have a conflict amendment on?
I don't think so.
We don't have any. We have paperwork, but no amendments. Okay.
Madam Chair, you have the revenue impact and the fiscal impact.
Correct. So we have everything we need, and we have no amendments. So Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3058 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 3058 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Telford.
I'm going to support this bill because I think it's the beginning of the recognition of the damage that Measure 67 is, and 66, depending on the pass-through issue, is doing in double taxing revenues in this state. I hate bills that just deal with one industry, but I'm hoping this at least opens the door so that we can talk about other C corporations that may have issues with double taxation. A little different situation, but still double taxation. And so, anyway, I hope this is the beginning of future industries being able to be brought into the discussion.
Okay. Other discussion? Okay. Any objection? So ordered. Senator Hash, you've been very quiet, so you can carry it.
Be happy to.
Okay. Now I'm going to open a work session.
I don't even know what we just talked about.
See, that one is day.
I think that's one you just got the, we just got the fiscal.
Yeah, we do have it, I think. Okay. And then this one is, okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2543. I think we just got our late-breaking fiscal, okay. Okay. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2543 because we don't have our fiscal. I got confused. We're not ready,
are we?
No. Okay. No. Sorry, committee, I got confused. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2679. I just got confused. That time in the session. Okay, Day.
Chair Birding, members of the committee, House Bill 2679, it confirms the Oregon Surplus Lines Law to the new federal law, and we have all the paperwork necessary for Dash A4, A7, and Dash A8. Let me just briefly explain Dash A4. It's about changing overpayment.
Why don't you start with A7,
okay,
which really pertains to the bill.
Dash A7 represents the consensus amendment. And what it does, it requires the director of DCBS to receive express legislative approval before entering into a compact.
I think we're going to take these one by one. I'd like Mr. Kosasan and Mr. Marquis to come up here on the Dash A7 amendment. And I would prefer to have you come up holding hands. Yes, come on, Lou.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Members of the committee, Jim Marquis, on behalf of the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon. Did you want us to sing Kumbaya?
Yes, I would like that, and harmony is preferred.
I would just say that we are pleased that Mr. Kosasan worked with us on these amendments, and we're fine.
Okay. Mr. Savage?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Luke Savage, Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We are fine with the amendment. We're happy to come back for approval of any agreement.
Okay. And by approval, you mean an actual legislative vote?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Kosasan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan, National Association of Professional Surplus Lines Offices. And we're pleased with the amendment, and in light of the status of the compact or any other multi-state agreement at the current time, I think the course outlined in the amendment is a prudent one.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Hess?
Question, does this still leave the three-fifths?
This still requires a three-fifths vote because the underlying, which I still have to admit I don't understand why, but... Senator Morris, everybody's, no questions on that?
Just a comment. I think from what I'm hearing, the express legislative approval satisfies my concerns that Gordon Howard posed with the just turning over carte blanche, so to speak. I'll pass the bill to the floor, but I still have concerns regarding the increase in tax, which I'm still resolving.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else want to say anything on the dash A7? Okay, now let's move to the dash A4.
Dash A4 makes changes in overpayment recovery procedures between health insurers and healthcare providers. And I think
Mr. Beringer and we have... anyone else who has participated in this in the audience?
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Beringer. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I have some written testimony being passed out, and I apologize. I tried to get to most of you, but some of you I was unable to get to personally. Want to quickly talk about the A4s. What you have in front of you represents a consensus agreement between American Health Insurance Plans, the ASCs, and Oregon Medical Association, very similar to an overpayment recovery bill that has already passed through this chamber, Senate Bill 573. The bill that went through this side was not agreed on universally, went over to the House side where we all sat down at the table and reworked the timelines and got to an agreement to include some pieces that were missing and also refine the timelines. The timelines that are currently reflected in this bill actually reflect what was the minority report on the Senate floor, so we've got agreement there as well. Why are we here? Because the agreement was too broad for the relating to clause of the existing bill we have, and so we're looking for a new vehicle to put this into. Just real quickly to recap, it's an agreement between AHEP, OMA, and OASCA. The concepts in this bill have had public hearings on both the House side and the Senate side. The concepts in this bill have passed the Senate side once already, and the reason we're here beyond deadlines is because we had a compromise between all of us that just was too broad for our existing relating clause. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Telfer.
So this is becoming the insurance Christmas tree bill, it seems. And so I just, clarification, this does incorporate the minority report's issues.
Okay. Correct.
Thank you.
Yes. My rules for this bill, which has a wonderful relating clause, were selected hitchhikers are welcome and no axe murderers are allowed. Elise, you want to say anything about it?
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, Elise Brown representing AHIP, and for the record, AHIP is America's Health Insurance Plans, and our members here in Oregon that have all reviewed the language and support it here today include Regents, Kaiser, Providence Health Plan, HealthNet, Pacific Source, and ODS. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay. Why don't you talk first?
Madam Chair, Rose Cox for the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, and we would just like to thank you for picking us up on the side of the road.
Okay. Thank you. You had a smile on your face, and you were very courteous, so that makes a difference. Okay, any other questions? Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who has one negative thing to say about the dash 4 amendment? I see none. Okay, Day, dash 8. A8 amendment.
Chairwoman members of the committee, dash A8 requires an insurer offering a health benefit plan that provides coverage of prescription eye drops, provide coverage for one early refill of a prescription for eye drops to treat glaucoma under specified conditions.
This is the eye drop drip down your cheek instead of going into your eye, Bill. So, Nan Heim? You want to come up and tell us about this? And do we have anybody from the optometrist? Yo, ooh, there you are, Bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Nan Heim, and I'm representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Our members are medical doctors specializing in eye care. The reason this bill is before you is that we heard about the issue that it addresses, the problem that it addresses, sometime after the session began. And we had a bill. We wanted to survey our members and make sure that the problem that we'd heard about from our national organization was indeed a problem in Oregon. We also wanted to see if the optometric physicians were interested in the bill with us, and they were. So we had a bill introduced in the House. And at that point, we wanted to see if the insurers had amendments, and we worked with John Powell, who suggested an amendment that we ended up supporting. This bill passed the House by a vote of 59-1 on June 1st, which unfortunately is too late for your process here in the Senate to be heard as a separate bill. The problem that it addresses is that some insurers, not all, were beginning to deny coverage of early refills of glaucoma drops. And it is very easy to use the wrong number of drops or spill, as you said, down your cheek. And some patients would decide that, okay, I can't refill this until the 30 days are up, so I'll just skip these last 3 days. And if you have glaucoma, that can be a very, that decision can have very dire consequences. So we truly believe that this bill could help some Oregonians save their vision. So we think it's worthy of your support. Thank you very much.
Bill, do you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We urge you to amend this provision into the bill as our ride apparently stalled in the President's office based on the policies of not moving the bills along after the deadline. Okay. So we would appreciate it.
Thank you. I see John Powell in the audience. Did you want to say anything, John? He does not. Well, I want to say something to you, and that is thank you for participating in this process constructively. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to talk on this? All right, so committee, we have a bill, an amendment, and two hitchhikers. And I would like to try to do this today because we have all the paperwork. So, Senator Morris, are you comfortable with a bunch of motions or some motions?
I'm comfortable with all three amendments, Madam
Chair. Okay, thank you. Okay, let's start with the dash A7.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2679, dated 6-9-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash A7 amendment to House Bill 2679. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2679, dated 6-7-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2679. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2679, dated 6-13-11. They just barely caught the bus.
But we might save some eyesight here. Senator Morris has moved the dash A8 amendment to House Bill 2679. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2679 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2679 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. So that committee, one of our last pieces of business will be the property tax deferral program, which we will take up on Wednesday. I encourage any of you, it's kind of complicated in some respects, so I encourage you to ask me or Paul or anybody to answer any questions you might have so we can be ready to roll this out on Wednesday, because we absolutely have to have this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hatch.
You said there would be some new somebody said there would be some new information on that bill regarding the common school bond in 2002.
Paul
Davidson, do it. No, I don't mean pause to come up. I mean, isn't there something that's going to be given to us, emailed to us?
Yes, Senator Haas, Madam Chair. Yeah, you had asked for Christine to put together the staff measure summary that included the amendment you adopted, the Dash A6. So she's done that and sent that to you to try to explain, you know, what the transfer is. Basically, it's a transfer that takes place within the current biennium. And the way it's characterized in terms of the Common School Fund is as an investment, because it will yield a return. There will be an interest equal to the average return of the assets in the fund. And then in the 13 session, you'll have the Department of Revenue report on the effect of the reforms you have in the bill, how they've affected the cash flow of the bill. But it'll be up to the legislature to make a determination of how that $19 million will be replenished to the Common School Fund. That may involve a longer-term plan. It may involve a short-term appropriation. But that would be a determination of the 13 legislature. The key would be to determine the long-term viability of the program. You know, our projections that we've talked with you about and talked with a great deal of length with the House Revenue Committee is we think that it is long-term financially viable based on the projections we have in terms of the flow, cash flow into the system as houses begin to turn over again and begin to see sales again. But, of course, that's not without risk, particularly given the weakness of the housing market now. So you'll in 13, you'll be in a position to assess a little bit better what the conditions are, and then you'll have to make a decision at that point. It doesn't absolve making that decision about the $19 million.
The foregoing has been an informational hearing on House Bill 2543. So are there questions?
Okay. No charge.
Thank you, Paul. We'll close the informational hearing on House Bill 2543, and we are adjourned. We are adjourned.